Welcome to the Progress Your Health podcast with your hosts, Dr. Robert Mackey and Dr. Valerie Davidson, a husband and wife team who specialize in bioidentical hormone replacement therapy and functional medicine. They're here to help you lose weight, balance hormones, and age gracefully. It's their mission to motivate, educate, and empower you to take your health to the next level. And now your hosts, hormone experts, Dr. Mackey and Dr. Davidson.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Progress Your Health Podcast. I'm Dr. Mackey.
And I'm Dr. Davidson.
So on the last episode, we discussed Tracy's question, which was about, you know, generally perimenopause, using estrogen, specifically biased. We gave some suggestions for that or some ideas for people to think about. This is her second question, and this one has to do with thyroid-related issues, or thyroid and perimenopause. So Dr. Davidson, why don't you go ahead and read Tracy's question?
All right, I'll take it away here. So here's Tracy's question. Hi, I do not have a thyroid gland and take compounded T4, T3 daily. I've also noticed that I am needing to take more thyroid hormone than I previously needed to keep the lab values in optimal ranges and to keep the hypothyroid symptoms at bay. It seems that the farther I get into perimenopause, the supplemental thyroid hormone I'm requiring is increasing as my sex hormones are naturally decreasing. Are naturally decreasing sex hormones and thyroid hormone optimization in the body related? Do you see this in your perimenopausal and menopausal patients, needing to supplement thyroid hormone to continue to achieve optimal results and acceptable symptoms? Thanks.
Yeah, so this there's a lot. There's a lot to unpack on this one because of course the perimenopausal into menopause transition, that 20-year span, 40 to 60 sort of thing. But it's even more complicated because she's had a thyroidectomy for some reason. She doesn't tell us why. You and I on the last episode, we sort of speculated that was probably due to cancer.
Yeah, thyroid cancer, usually you have to take out the entire thyroid gland and you don't want any of it to grow back, because whenever you remove a thyroid gland, there's always a few cells left over. So the idea is to keep that suppressed, which is why it would be necessary, if it were the case with Tracy that she had a thyroid cancer, which honestly, if you're going to have a cancer, thyroid cancer is probably the one you want to have. Yeah. You remove the gland and you keep that, and you basically keep the cells from growing back by keeping, like Tracy says, the thyroid doses optimized, so you have that thyroid kind of that high normal level to keep any thyroid cells that are hanging around from growing back. Now, I could go way into all the treatments, you know, so many years later, you can do this with the TSH, that with the TSH, but in this case, I'm thinking probably she had it removed due to cancer. You can also have it removed due to Graves' disease, you know, having that super hyperthyroid. I would have thought if it were Graves' disease, she may have mentioned that, because I do treat people with previous Graves' disease thyroid dosing a little bit different than somebody with Hashimoto's or somebody different with having just generalized hypothyroid.
Yeah, I've seen that over the years too. Like there's some questionable reasons right now. Sometimes the patient doesn't exactly know all the details. They just, you know, oh, I just had my thyroid removed. They don't really know why or what they had or what the situation. Cancer seems like the most likely reason, but nodules, you don't need your thyroid removed.
But I have seen some patients that have had part of their thyroid removed, sure, due to nodules or hyperthyroid.
But that's also a little bit of an overreaction. You don't need to take your thyroid out because you got nodules are actually normal in about, you know, 15 to 20% of the population. And there's this idea that nodules sort of, you know, can lead to cancer, which is sort of like a little bit of a fallacy. Now, you and I have seen, not a lot because it's not really that common, at least not for our type of practice, but we have seen quite a few hyperthyroid cases over the years. Like you said, specifically Graves' disease, which is an autoimmune thyroid, kind of like the opposite of Hashimoto's. Even though Hashimoto's can kind of wax and wane in the early stages, you can be hyper, hypo, you know, for a little while. Again, not really a reason to remove someone's thyroid for that. There's some better ways to be able to manage those situations. So you and I both assume that it's, you know, in Tracy's case, it is related to cancer.
So I would say just in general, I really do like her question, because she's along the right lines. As some, you know, forget having a thyroid and not having a thyroid. Let's just say generalized hypothyroid, someone's on thyroid medication. as a female, as those hormones are changing in perimenopause and menopause, I do notice that we do have to change up doses of that thyroid. Now, granted, the thyroid's a little bit interesting. Sometimes it wants to work more and sometimes it wants to work less, that it is important to continually check those thyroid levels to have them optimized. I mean, people can be on thyroid medication and, you know, it's okay, but it ideally when you're looking at, you know, just anti-aging, feeling good, quality of life, is you want to have those thyroid levels optimized, that T4 and T3, as she's saying, which we'll get into a little bit about dosing. But I do notice, and you probably notice too, that, you know, as perimenopause and menopause, you do notice that some of those levels are lower and you have to adjust for that.
Yeah, when you're managing a patient over time, you see with their lab work, you see the data sort of accumulate and you start to see trends in their numbers, whatever numbers you're looking at, whether it's a hemoglobin A1C number, a fasting glucose, a fasting insulin, or in this case, a TSH. You do start to see that as they get closer and closer to menopause, you start to see that TSH start to climb. Let's say when they were menstruating age, you know, let's say early to mid 30s, their TSH will be right around 1, you know, 0.7 to 1.2, perfectly good TSH number. And as they get closer to 50 and beyond, that number will end up being, you know, 2.5, 3.5, 4.5, sometimes even abnormal. And putting Hashimoto's aside for a second, because Hashimoto's is a really big topic. Just primary hypothyroid, it is sort of really a middle-aged woman problem. And to Tracy's point, you get to that certain point in your life. Of course, when you're talking hormones, all the hormones are connected in one way or the other. So if you get a drop in one hormone or a couple hormones, estrogen, progesterone, you're going to see a compensation somewhere else. And sometimes that compensation is hard to predict, exactly where that's going to show up. So, definitely. Now, one thing I want to say about thyroid cancer, all the craze around the GLP-1 medications, the semaglutide, the liraglutide, the tirzepatide, there is a increased risk potential for developing thyroid cancer from using those types of medications. If you have a strong, obviously, if you've had it before, probably not a great idea. But again, what's the risk if you've already had your thyroid removed? And then you do some of those medications. Where does the risk translate to? Does it translate into another type of cancer, another endocrine cancer? Or are you sort of safe because the thyroid's already been removed? So if you've had a strong family history, you might want to think twice about using some of those GLP-1 medications. The other one that I've heard of recently is pancreatitis. There's an increased risk of developing pancreatitis, which I've never had, you've never had, but I heard that is excruciatingly painful, can be dangerous, right? So you definitely have to, sort of a medical emergency. It's so painful that you can't ignore it necessarily. Those are the two things that I've heard that are increased risk from using those types of medication. Anyways, just a little side note.
No, I think that's important. And that's, you know, those semaglutide medications are so popular right now. It's nice for you to throw in that caveat. I'm asking you, which, you know, we work with hormones all the time. What do you think the mechanism of action with that thyroid hormone dropping as someone's going into menopause and perimenopause? Do you think it's like you were saying, the estrogen and progesterone are all the hormones are in our body between the adrenals, the thyroid, the female reproductive hormones? Do you find that they're so interconnected that one, when a couple start to decline, the other, like you said, have to compensate, and then you see changes in the adrenal gland hormones as well as the thyroid hormones?
Yeah, this is where it gets, when you think of the bigger picture, I think of hormones in the body as sort of, you know, they're, granted there's different tiers of them, but you have your, what I would consider your primary hormones, insulin, cortisol, thyroid. There's other ones, but those are the ones that most people have heard of before. There's lots of content on social media about that and on the internet about those three hormones specifically. Then you have your secondary hormones, which is, you know, in this context is your female hormones. Now, most of the time, at least the way that I think about it in my brain, is that the primary hormones, the insulin, cortisol, thyroid, influence the secondary, but not too much of the secondary influencing the primary, right? However, what we're talking about here is sort of a direct contradiction to that idea. If the female hormones are dropping, which in my idea is a secondary hormone, then how does that impact on the thyroid? Unless the drop in female hormones props up cortisol, Okay. Because there's a definite, you know, kind of shift there where a woman's body becomes a little bit more reactive to cortisol. Now, granted, this is not out of a physiology textbook. This is more kind of practical, kind of a down and dirty, you know, we're not, you know, trying to cite exact physiology here. We're talking in broad sweeping terms a buffer to cortisol is gone when you're in menopause. Cortisol responsiveness goes up. That's why you gain the spare tire around the midsection. And then now that rise or that responsiveness to cortisol reduces thyroid function. At least that's kind of how I think about it. What are your thoughts?
Oh, absolutely. I was just saying, or actually thinking in my head, that when I have a female patient, I always, especially in perimenopause and definitely menopause, always check the thyroid. Even if they say, oh yeah, I had my TSH checked, the TSH range, so the TSH is a thyroid stimulating hormone. It's basically a releasing factor or a stimulating hormone that comes from your brain, from the pituitary, that monitors the overall thyroid function. So if that thyroid function goes down, you see that TSH numbers start to go up. The reference range for TSH based, you know, depending on the labs, are 0.45 to 4.5. That's a huge reference range. So if somebody's at 4.4, while that might be a normal reference range, their thyroid function is a whole lot different than someone with a TSH at 0.7. So I want to see where that TSH level is. Now, just relying on a TSH level as thyroid function or even as dosing of thyroid medication is you want to look at that free T4 and free T3. Now, you can have total T4 and total T3 checked, but when you check the free hormones, that's the bioactive, the available hormone that's for use in the moment. So I always look at that T4, that free T4, the free T3, and the TSH, you know, as a baseline in anybody that comes in that's in perimenopause, and like I said, especially menopause. So you definitely see a change when, you know, is it age? Is it hormones? Is it environment? Is it stress? Is it life? Who knows? But you definitely see that change in those years of perimenopause and menopause with thyroid function. Now, when I'm doing thyroid hormone bioidentical hormone replacement, such as a biest, an estrogen, a progesterone replacement therapy with somebody that's in menopause, then I absolutely do check the thyroid, because you do find that in certain dosings of estradiol, it can suppress your levels of T3. So anytime you're giving somebody estradiol hormone therapy, you want to check those levels of T3 to see if you need to, raise up those levels of T3, because it is something that happens.
Yeah, you'll see sort of two things happening. You'll see the TSH go up a little bit, and you'll see the free T3 go down a little bit. Now, another thing I was thinking of as you were talking, another thing that happens sort of inevitably, which is why hypothyroid sort of becomes a middle-aged woman issue, is they become just by getting older, we become more insulin resistant as time goes forward. And there's a definite connection between hypothyroid and insulin sensitivity. So the more blood sugar dysregulation, the more higher your fasting insulin is, that is going to have a direct impact on your thyroid function. And even things like fatty liver disease, if you have elevated CRP levels, if you have elevated liver enzymes, in our experience, that usually translates to fatty liver disease. If you get a liver ultrasound and it comes back on there, or if you've had gallbladder problems in the past and it says on there, oh yeah, you're having an acute gallbladder attack. Oh, by the way, you have fatty liver. The fatty liver is why you have the gallbladder problem. You can't, a gallbladder problem is just an extension of the liver. They can't take your liver out, so they can, you know, they can reduce your pain in the short term by taking out the gallbladder. But now that impact of insulin on your liver starts to change the functioning of your liver, which honestly, there's a lot of talk about T3 conversion from T4 to T3. 60% of that T3 conversion from T4 to T3 is happening in your liver. So the better your liver functions, meaning the less insulin resistant you are, the better your thyroid is going to function as well. So, so it's a few things happening there. Some of it is related to the decline in female hormones. Some of it is just part of the natural aging process, that your thyroid becomes less efficient over time. Now, Tracy's a little bit different. Tracy is 100% dependent on medication. Okay, Tracy, for all of you that are, sort of thinking about it, she can never go off thyroid medication. She has to be on thyroid medication forever because she doesn't have a actual gland anymore. So she's 100% dependent on medication.
Absolutely. So, but it is interesting. So she's a great sort of case study because she doesn't have a thyroid. So there's no thyroid there, you know, pulsing out some hormone or not pulsing out some hormone. So she has no thyroid, completely dependent on her thyroid medication. She's been on a particular dose, and now she's having to raise it because she's in perimenopause, transitioning into menopause. Why is that? Because she has no thyroid. Now, like you said, there's so many other factors. It's almost like a moving target, honestly. It could be when the hormone levels drop, like you said, the insulin levels can rise up, you can gain weight. So there could be just the idea of more body mass versus dosage. You have a higher body mass, you got to raise up the dosage. Now, it's interesting because when I see a lot of people, when they lose weight, you think there's less body mass for the dosage, but the dose actually is fine, or sometimes they need to alter it. So it's not just about, you know, A plus B equals C. I gained weight, so I need more thyroid. That could be the case here. It could be just like you said, the you know, the adrenal hormones are changing, the cortisol is changing. If it's just the progesterone dropping in perimenopause, I mean, I love estrogen. Estrogen is the best hormone in the entire world. But estradiol in not being buffered by the other hormones can also cause weight gain. So there's so many other factors that could be, you know, could be influencing her thyroid dose.
Yeah, that's why endocrinology just in general is sort of fascinating, because everything in the body, that's why even when it comes to the human body and modern medicine, you cannot reduce the body into systems as easily as modern medicine try to do. You got to go to the lung doctor, you got to go to the brain doctor, you got to go to the heart doctor, you got to go to the female hormone doctor, you got to go to all these different doctors. There's not really enough doctors these days that are looking at the entire picture, you know, the holistic approach, the whole body approach. That's what you and I try to do all the time. I know, granted, with functional medicine and the rise of that, I mean, certainly it's happening on a fairly large scale, but not necessarily as conventionally as it needs to happen. That's why these things are sort of fascinating from a, you know, kind of science nerd brain perspective, trying to figure out how you're going to intervene that ultimately is going to help someone, you know, feel better, perform better, function better, at the same time improving some objective data, you know, their lab values. So it's sort of a really fun, not that we're experimenting on people, but it's really fun to see these things improve. I'm going off on a tangent there. I'm not really sure. I kind of lost my point there, but it is. You know, like I said, it's just very multifactorial. There's lots of things to take into consideration. However, you know, with women in this age range between their 40s and 60s, it's fairly easy to put in some interventions that are not going to be too complicated for them, so their lives are already complicated enough, but something that's going to actually, you know, tangibly make them feel better on a daily basis.
Yeah, and I love working with thyroid. So whenever I'm doing hormones with the patient, you know, with hormone replacement, bioidentical hormone replacement, I'm always looking at that thyroid and seeing what we can do to optimize that, whether it's with medication or there's so many other even supplementation and lifestyle factors you can do for the thyroid to help, you know, increase up that conversion of, like you said, the T4 to the T3, because our thyroid gland, now hence Tracy doesn't have one, but those of us that have a thyroid gland are making a lot of, you know, making the T4. Then that T4 travels in the peripheral tissues. And like Dr. Mackey said, mostly in the liver, that T4 will convert to T3, which T3 is the active form of thyroid pretty much. So so I love looking at those free T3 and free T4 levels. What's also really cool about Tracy's question is she's on compounded T3, T4. So there's, when people think of thyroid medication, they may not be aware that there are actually many different types of thyroid combinations you can do and different thyroid medications.
Yeah, you and I are not big fans of using what they call T4 monotherapy. You know, the branded things you get at a big box pharmacy, we're not really big fans of using those exclusively. That's why this is such a great question, because what Tracy's taking, compounded T3, T4, the base hormones, T4 is levothyroxine, T3 is triiodothyronine. That's the generic form of both of those hormones. We always do it in a sustained release format because that minimizes some of the potentially negative side effects that people are, where all the commercial ones, all the ones you get from a big box pharmacy, they're all instant release. So we prefer, in most, probably 90% of our thyroid cases, we prefer the compounded thyroid, even yourself. I mean, you've been on compounded thyroid for, you know, quite a long time, yeah, as the best option available out there for, you know, for thyroid thyroid medication.
I mean, in terms of the instant release, those big box, you know, Synthroid, levothyroxine, those will affect the TSH and put that back into, you know, a range of maybe one, you know, because I see the TSH between 0.45 and 1.5. I think that's a really good level for the TSH.
Say that really fast. Say that again. Optimal range for a TSH?
Oh, for me, I like to see the patients with the TSH at 0.45 to 1.5. I think that's a really good range. Mm-hmm. Over 2.5, that just means that in my opinion, the thyroid function is a little bit too low, or the overall thyroid function. Now, the instant release, like you were saying, the big box Synthroid, levothyroxine, it will affect the TSH, but it doesn't necessarily optimize the T4 and the T3.
Right.
So like Dr. Mackey said, you know, full transparency, I'm on thyroid, I'm on a compounded sustained release T4, T3. I'm imagining Tracy probably is too. Most compounded T4, T3s do come as sustained release. Now, there's also porcine thyroid made from a pig's thyroid. It's natural thyroid. There's NP thyroid. Used to be Nature Thyroid, that's not around anymore to be found.
I think it is, but I was having some sourcing problems. So we sort of really phased, unfortunately, mm-hmm. we sort of phased away from it because they were having so many sourcing problems and they just couldn't get any doses. So people, I think, have moved on to NP Thyroid and still Armor.
And I really like the RLC Labs that makes the Nature Thyroid, but you're right. But those porcine thyroids are still also instant release, but they do have a T4 and a T3 component to it. Now, everybody's different. A lot of people do really well on the porcine thyroid. Some people do well on the Synthroid and levothyroxine. That, you know, everybody's different. Another podcast that maybe you listeners have already listened to is we talk about perimenopause and menopause and anxiety. So some people are having that anxiety, which is a very common symptom in perimenopause and especially menopause, both as well, is if they're having anxiety, doing an instant release thyroid can sometimes exacerbate that anxiety because thyroid is going right into your system. So somebody that's already anxious, it can kind of put a little pressure on that system of creating more anxiety, where I find the sustained release in somebody that might be more of anxious by nature, that the sustained release can really alleviate that.
Yeah. And even, you know, of course, when it comes to thyroid, everyone's worried about cardiovascular side effects, you know, increased heart rate, palpitations. Now, when it comes to thyroid dosing and cardiovascular issues or side effects, if you're having intermittent palpitations, like just random palpitations, it's not your thyroid medication. Thyroid medication, if your dose is too high, it is going to be almost like you've had a really strong cup of coffee, that anxiousness or jittery feeling, it just doesn't go away, right? That usually is a sustained feeling that you're going to have from thyroid, not just because you had a random palpitation spurt on a Tuesday afternoon. Honestly, that's usually related either transitioning into menopause, so your estrogen's dropping, leading to palpitations. We'll talk about that later in another episode.
That was probably on another episode.
I think we just talked about that on the heart one not that long ago, that palpitations is a, you know, if you're approaching 50 or shortly after 50 and you're having palpitations on a regular basis, that's a classic symptom of having low estrogen levels. How do you know that? You put someone on some estrogen cream and the palpitations disappear. Or if it's a younger woman that's not in menopause yet, then it usually is a stress response. So the higher your stress, the more palpitations, you mitigate the stress or, you know, support the stress response and the palpitations go away. So thyroid is usually more if the medication dose is too high. And if anyone out there that has ever been over-medicated on thyroid, you know exactly what we're talking about. You cannot ignore that feeling. It is, you know, granted, we try not to do that to our patients, right? That's one of our, you know, one of the things we're trying to avoid early on in the process. The other thing is too, if you've been on a dose for a while, let's say months, even years, you don't automatically, or at least in most cases, become hyperthyroid the longer you've been on a dose. If you're going to be somewhat intolerant of either a medication or a dose change, it's going to be in the first 2 weeks. It's going to happen right away. We usually tell our patients the first 7 to 10 days on a start of a medication or an increase of a dose of the same medication, you're potentially may experience some of those things, but it's right away. You're not going to develop that, you know, months down the road or even years down the road. Something else is going on. But, you know, we've had plenty of patients ourselves that end up in the emergency room. They're like, oh, it's your thyroid. You got to lower your dose. yeah, that's a little bit of an overreaction sometimes. But it's something that other practitioners sort of gravitate towards as explaining as to why they're why it's happening. I mean, we run into that more times than we would like to, something to think about as you're assessing if you're having these cardiovascular symptoms. Nobody wants to experience that. It's definitely very scary when it does. But again, if it's just a random thing, it's usually not related to the medication dose.
Yeah, I want to say, I think it was episode 140 that will be out once this episode is out. That one we did a question on a patient that's in menopause, just starting some hormone therapy, and she was having palpitations, and she was wondering if that was because of menopause. And she had already seen their cardiologist, got checked out, so it wasn't a heart issue. So I think that one is episode 140, if anybody's interested in listening to that one about palpitations and menopause. See, lots of things can happen in menopause, huh?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's not just about hot flashes and no. Night sweats. It's a lot more complicated than that. And I think finally with the social media and YouTube and all the information that's out there, I think people, at least patients anyways, women that are experiencing these things are finally realizing that, hey, this is sort of not a great situation. Conventionally, I think, is where everything is kind of falling behind. Medicine does not evolve very quickly, except for practices like yours and I's. We evolve very quickly. At least we try to anyways. We try to adapt because, our practice, if you think about a small practice that doesn't have a bureaucracy like a big hospital or a big medical group, every patient, it's like our practice is like one big research study. And we're tracking people in real time, adjusting as we go. So you're able to find what works and what doesn't a lot faster than, the bigger healthcare system in general. And I think there's a big shift across the country, functional medicine and other practitioners like you and I, that are kind of one being driven by patients looking for answers to their situations, and then practitioners that are trying to facilitate that that desire and need, because medicine, in this country really hasn't evolved very well. Very good on the trauma side, very good on the acute side, sort of, not so great on chronic conditions necessarily. So, that's why these things are, and that's why these questions are so great, because it really is. This is, kind of the new frontier of medicine, some of the things that we're talking about, and moving forward, all the changes that are going to happen over the next 5 to 10 years, AI and all the different things we can use to our advantage is pretty incredible. I mean, it really, really is.
And that's why I really liked this question from Tracy. Is, I know we talk a lot about menopause and perimenopause, that's our niche here, but she had mentioned, about the thyroid in menopause, and it was kind of like a ding ding moment. Like, of course, when a patient comes into me and they're in menopause or perimenopause, I'll say, oh, have you had your thyroid checked? Because, oh yeah, it's normal. Well, how long ago was that? That might've been before they went to perimenopause. And so I say, well, let's have a look at it now, because things do change when your hormones change. So now I'm thinking back on all our past podcasts. I haven't said to any listeners, if you are going through perimenopause and menopause and you're maybe doing some treatment with some functional medicine doctors, or maybe getting some labs done with your gynecologist or your GP, consider having your thyroid rechecked. Even if you just had it checked several, 3 or 4 years ago, have it rechecked just to make sure that it's in optimal
range.
Even
3 or 4 months ago. Yeah. In some cases.
Yeah, because, perimenopause is a phase, just like menopause is a phase, and everybody is different on how long that lasts for them.
Now, do you hear from your patients too, that when they are transitioning into perimenopause, like one day they're fine and then overnight they're not? It's like a flip of a light switch. Like, mm-hmm. They're just doing life, doing their thing. And all of a sudden, just almost instantaneously, they feel totally different. Now, maybe it's not a matter of one day to the next, but, over a period of a month or two or three or four. I talked to a patient just the other day. 3 months ago, she felt fine. 3 months later, now her cycle's out of whack. She just doesn't feel the same. So literally in a matter of 90 days, she went from feeling, she's 47. She's going to be 48, in August. Right. And then just like that, almost like a snap of the fingers, she feels different. She goes, I said, what's the timing? Just get me back to where I felt 3 months ago, let alone 3 years ago, or let alone 10 years ago. Just get me back to where I felt 3 months ago. Some of those things are unavoidable, right? This is the problem with perimenopause, is that the hormonal changes, some of them are inevitable. They're going to happen. There's nothing we can do about it. It's the It's where we pick to intervene and how we try to compensate for those changes that sort of dictate how the patient's going to feel.
No, actually what you're saying is true. That's why when someone comes to you, like you're saying, oh, I feel terrible, but 3 months ago I felt great. Well, why didn't you come to me when you started not feeling good? Because it does happen. That's why I do think, you know, that's having that relationship with a patient, or even like I was just thinking, we're creating a community for women that you will join. We have a waiting list right now, that women can come in and ask their questions without having to wait to go see somebody, you know, 6 months from now or a year from now, because things change. So like you said, things can change in 90 days. A lot of my perimenopausal females that we talk to, things can change within that 28-day cycle or their cycle. A lot of women will say, because in perimenopause, you know, that progesterone drops first, is they don't feel great before their period. They don't feel great during their period, but a lot of women feel really good right before ovulation. And then right after ovulation is when the irritability comes in, the rage can come in, the weight gain can come in, the munchies, the carb cravings come in, but then they have their period. And then right before ovulation, they're like, I felt really great. And then I say, well, who wants to have 1 week out of four to feel great? I'd rather have the majority of the month feeling great rather than just 1 week.
So It's I hear those things all the time, and you know, that's why we continue to, you know, partially because the marketplace in some ways has pushed us this way, right? When I was in school, I didn't think I was gonna be working exclusively with female hormones, but the market sort of dictates what they, you know, what the desire and the need is, and you sort of fill that spot. You know, you've been doing it exclusively this way for a very long time, and that's why you're sort of the, you know, the hormone master. Over the years, you've acquired a lot of amazing experience and knowledge about how to deal with these, you know, these very particular situations. So now let's get back to, because there's some other key things about this case with Tracy, because she doesn't have a thyroid gland. One thing to keep in mind, especially when you're using compounded T3, T4, this is for Tracy and everyone else that is using compounded thyroid, is their dose, comparatively to the conventional medications, their dose is always, especially in Tracy's case, because she doesn't have a thyroid gland, the thyroidectomy patients, the ones that have had it removed, always have the highest dosage, bar none, right? And their doses sometimes can get a little uncomfortable as far as what the T4 dose is.
Uncomfortable for you?
Uncomfortable as far as what the number is.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Right? A T4 dose might be over 200 micrograms. A T3 dose might be over 30 to 60 micrograms. Some doses that would, you know, that you would probably never prescribe with an instant release, you know, a levothyroxine or a Cytomel. Cytomel is instant release T3. We are not fans of instant release T3 because it's instant release. Leothyronine is still basically Cytomel, but the sustained release tones down some of those negative consequences or negative side effects of the instant release medications. That's why we feel that really the best option for thyroid replacement medication is the compounded thyroid.
Yeah, compounded sustained release T4, T3 thyroid is like apples to oranges compared to Synthroid or levothyroxine or those instant release. And even also too with the Armour and the porcine thyroids, mm-hmm. all those instant release are completely different. So a sustained release T4, T3, like I said, it just doesn't have that like that anxiousness. It doesn't have that irritability to the heart if some people are having too high a dose of the instant release. But you're right, when I have patients and they tell their, you know, some other doctors on their healthcare team, oh, this is the thyroid that I'm taking, their other doctors are like, you know, in some ways their eyes are like, you know, popping out because they're like, you're on what dose of T4? Because a Synthroid or levothyroxine of 100 micrograms is so different than a T4 of 100 micrograms. So it is.
Well, that's really where you're the master. There's a bunch of conversion charts out there on the internet of converting someone that's on Synthroid or Armour or any one of those commercial prescriptions to compounded thyroid. Don't let your doctor dose you based on those conversion charts, because it's like It's like you're reducing the dose. If you go from what it says in those, all of those charts are all wrong. I don't know who put those together, but they're all sort of the same thing. Whoever put those together is not a clinician, and they must have been done by pharmacists, because if you follow those conversion charts and you go from, let's just say, Synthroid or levothyroxine to compounded, it is like reducing your dose by half, if not more. So that's why I think compounded thyroid gets a bad reputation, because most doctors, even the functional medicine doctors that should know better, even the pharmacists that should know better, they are always underdosing people. So now patients like, I feel terrible. This compounded thyroid sucks. I don't want to be on it anymore. And then they have to go back to some, you know, something else. You're the master at that. You take a dose and you can like whip up, okay, this, this, and this. And it seems a little obnoxious sometimes, but just because you're experienced, you have to compensate in that way to make up for going from an instant release to a sustained release. You're really the master at that.
Well, it's really the difference between an instant release T3 and a sustained release T3. So in the compounded T4, T3, a lot of doctors and pharmacists think that the T3 is so much more active than the T4. And I can understand the rationale, because like I said, the T3 is the active form of thyroid in your body. You know, the T4 really has a really nice, beautiful, long half-life, but it converts over to T3, and the T4, active form.
And T4 doesn't do anything.
It can cross the blood-brain barrier.
It's an inactive hormone. It doesn't do anything in your body.
It's important. It's important. But they get worried thinking that T3, if I dose them with a T4, T3 from a T4 monotherapy only, that T3 is going to be so darn active that I better really keep that dose low. And then their TSH, I've seen people on Synthroid where their TSH is, you know, 1 or 0.5, and it goes up to 30, you know, because there's, in fact, not too long ago, I was talking to somebody and they had switched someone from 100 micrograms of Synthroid or T4, levothyroxine, T4 monotherapy, to a compounded T4, T3 that was only 38 micrograms of T4 and 9 micrograms of T3, because they're thinking with those conversion charts that that's going to be equivalent to a levothyroxine instant release, 100 micrograms, and it really isn't.
Oh God, it's not even close.
I understand the rationale. If you want to start low, just make sure that you work with that patient or anybody that's working with you, you know, converting that over to, let's check it, you know, in a month and see where that is and raise it up. Let's check it again, because it is a process to do that conversion. So of course it's always better to underdose than overdose.
Based on, you know, now granted, you know, you are pretty good about sort of picking where that, I ask you all the time, hey, this is their dose. What would you change it to? And pretty good about that, but I wouldn't say you're aggressive. You're just, from experience, you're picking a dose that is going to get them to where they want to be as quickly as possible. So there's a little bit of management or adjustment, because you want their transition to be fairly smooth. Now, people that come to us on, let's say, the T4 monotherapy, they don't feel good. That T4 monotherapy, the big box medications, the T4 ones specifically, maybe not the porcine ones as much, that medication is going to do a really good job of lowering your TSH. That's all it does. All it does is lower your TSH, and it'll lower your TSH very, very easily. Your TSH will go down, partially because it is an instant release medication. But just because your TSH is low doesn't mean that you're going to feel any better, right? So the ones that come to us are on those medications already, and they don't feel very good, right? If they felt great on that medication, then fine. And there's plenty of them that are that do function well that way, but there's a big percentage of them that are on those medications, which is why they're coming to us. Their doctor won't change it, but they still don't feel it. It's almost like they feel hypothyroid again anyways, even though they're on 100, 125, 150 micrograms of T4 only. Now, usually in that situation, what tends to happen, the higher that T4 dose goes, then you're getting a rise to their reverse T3 at the same time. And that sort of puts the brakes on the thyroid, actually reduces over time your T3 level, which is the one we're actually trying to have an impact on. We switch them over. We exclusively use either the porcine-based ones, because there's T4, T3 in there, or we prefer the compounded. What do you think is the, and this is a rhetorical question, I know the answer, but what do you think is the real advantage of using compounded thyroid?
You can do any microgram you want. Tracy's talking about optimizing her T4 and T3 thyroid levels. You can change your, you know, where like Synthroid, you might have 50 micrograms, 75 micrograms, 88 micrograms, 100, 112. Yeah, that seems like those are
a lot. Or you got to cut something in half and piece them together.
Or take a higher dose on a Friday and, you know, everything else on the rest of the days. Where with that T4, T3, you can do any even quarter of a microgram dose change if you wanted to really tailor it to that individual. So I have lots of people on sustained release compound T4, T3 thyroid, and lots of people are on all different doses because everybody's an individual.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I see you and I are so in tune, right?
Aren't we?
Because I was going to say exactly the same thing. It gives the patient, it is in the best interest of the patient. Now, the unfortunate part is most insurance companies don't cover compounded thyroid. Some do, but some don't. But it is in the best interest of the patient. Because of what you just said, you can custom tailor that dosage. You can independently, because those two hormones, the T4 and the T3, the levothyroxine and the triiodothyronine, are put into a capsule based on the prescription written by the doctor. But you can manipulate each one of those independently. Now, let's say Armour, for example, it is, 60 milligrams, 90 milligrams, 120 milligrams. You can't, if you change the dose, you are changing both the, if you're increasing it, you're changing both T4, T3. If you're lowering it, you're changing T4, T3. In the compounded, you can independently change both medications. It gives the practitioner so much flexibility, as to what you said, to kind of hone in on that right dose and really optimize their thyroid numbers.
Yeah, so I think what you're meaning is with the Armour or the porcine thyroid, it does have T4 and T3 in there, which is great. It has, but the T4 and the T3 are a 4-to-1 ratio. You can't really change that. So like a 1 grain of thyroid is 38 micrograms of T4 with 9 micrograms of T3. If you do a half a grain, that would be 19 micrograms over, 9 divided by 2,
4.5.
4.5. You can't move that around. So I have some people that are on porcine thyroid and it's difficult because their T3 might still be low, even though their T4 is good and their TSH, I can't really raise the dose because it would put that T4 too high, but that T3 is still low. So then we end up working on, because there are ways you can do lifestyle and supplementation wise to be able to help that conversion of the T4 to T3. But like I said, it's not as easy as like, oh great, their T4 is good, their TSH, is good, but that T3 is low, so I can just raise up that T3, keep the T4 the same when I'm on that compounded sustained release changes. So yeah. I know this might be getting into the weeds here, but it is, I find it really interesting. And
well, this is the our nerdy science brain yeah. coming out. Now let's make it even, let's go down the little rabbit hole a little further. So just to back up. So you mentioned, the porcine base, so Armour, 60 milligrams of Armour is broken down into, as you said, just to recap what you said, 38 micrograms of T4, 9 micrograms of T3. That is considered to be 1 grain of thyroid.
Yeah, in old school language, I don't even know if people call it grains anymore.
Well, I think pharmacists do. Pharmacists do.
I think by milligrams.
I think pharmacists understand. You tell them 3 grains, 2 grains, 2.5 grains. They know what that number means. At least the pharmacies that we work with. I don't even know where I think you're right. The grains is like a early 20th century kind of a thing. Armour has been around for 100 years. It was the only medication for a very long time. And then I think I don't even know when Synthroid came out, in the 50s or something, 50s or 60s. I should know that, but I don't, not that I care. But grains. So when you're doing a compounded thyroid dose, you kind of do it in, so 38.9 is 1 grain, 76.18 is 2 grains, 114, 27 is 3 grains. And of course you have the half grain in between. But to your point, when you said a minute ago, you can sort of manipulate those and pick any number you want. On the T4, you can pick, 72, 71, 69, 68, 73, whatever number you want, and you can pick any microgram amount you want on the T3, and it gives so much flexibility. You don't have to maintain that 4-to-1 ratio. We have quite a few people. Let's talk about her, we'll come back to that my idea in a second. Let's talk about TSH in relationship to Tracy's situation.
Well, there are different theories that are changes in protocol. Originally, when I started working with thyroid, was someone had thyroid cancer, you remove that thyroid and you always keep that TSH suppressed. If the TSH...
What does suppressed mean?
So the TSH is a thyroid stimulating hormone. So of course, the higher the TSH, the lower the thyroid function. The lower the TSH, the higher the thyroid function. So you want to keep that TSH nice and low, under 0.5. I would always keep it right around, ideally around 0.2 to 0.3, 0.3, 0.35, to which would technically be out of range, you know, but you've got to keep it in that lower range, because when that TSH is suppressed, it's low, it keeps those little cells that might be hanging out, because you can't completely take all the cells. You remove the thyroid gland, but there's going to be a couple of cells hanging around, but it keeps those cells from multiplying, because I have seen patients where their TSH wasn't suppressed and they had a little bit of the thyroid gland grow back. Now, is it going to grow back?
How do you monitor that?
Ultrasound.
Blood test wise, blood test, how do you monitor that growth, the growth of those cells? Thyroglobulin?
Yeah, exactly. You want to do the thyroglobulin and make sure that's suppressed.
It's not thyroglobulin, not thyroglobulin antibodies Hashimoto's, just straight thyroglobulin. So Tracy, I'm sure her doctor is doing that, but she should be monitoring her thyroglobulin, just thyroglobulin. Hopefully, you know, her TSH is, this is where, you know, the reason why I asked you to talk about that is because the TSH really does not matter in these people. It doesn't matter.
Now, some theories, protocols are changing recently in the last few years, saying that if you've been thyroid cancer free for so many years, I think it's 7, you can allow that TSH to get into normal range. I still find that somebody that doesn't have a thyroid does really well when that TSH is definitely that thyroid level is on the high end of normal. Because I've had patients with thyroid cancer and you put them in quote unquote normal range. Maybe their TSH is at 3.5 and their free T3 is in the low 3s and their free T4 is maybe 1. They don't feel as good as when you have the levels on the higher end of normal. So, I mean, I could go on forever about thyroid levels and doses, and then we'd be here for the rest of the afternoon. But I still feel, even if they are 7+ years out from thyroid cancer, to really keep that TSH on that lower end.
Oh, and really, when you're using a combination thyroid, compounded thyroid, you're trying to do two things. You're trying to push down the TSH. So what we're trying to do with a compounded thyroid specifically, the goal of medication is to have a low normal TSH, or in this case with Tracy, a slightly below normal TSH, you know,
if it was thyroid cancer,
slightly below normal TSH to actually have it suppressed, and then a high normal free T3. In your mind, what do you consider to be a high normal free T3? What's your optimal range for a T3 if they're taking compounded thyroid?
Oh, 3.7 to 4.4.
Yeah. Now some people, you know, they will have, another question, what do you think about timing of medication and in regards to blood testing? Do they take it or do they skip it?
I like to see, cause I already know if they're not going to take their thyroid medication in the morning and they're going to have a blood draw, it's going to be on the low end of normal. I want to see if they're actually absorbing their thyroid. So most of the time I'll have people, you know, people will take their thyroid in the morning and then they have their blood draw about 5 hours later. That's good to see. Are they absorbing it? Is it staying in their system as opposed to not taking it in the morning? Sometimes I'll have people do it, you know, quote unquote fasting, where they don't take their thyroid at all in the morning just to see what their levels are at on their own. But really, I like to have them take their thyroid and test it 5 hours later. And then that gives me the ability to see, do I need to raise up that T3 a little bit, change up that T4, keep the T3 the same, raise up the T4. It gives you a lot more versatility rather than someone that comes in, which I see that often. Oh yeah, I didn't take my thyroid in the morning. I'm like, I can tell. Okay, now we got to figure out what kind of thyroid dose we want to change it to.
Yeah, right. Yeah, there's a lot of talk on the internet about skipping your dose in the morning. The TSH in a 24-hour period, your TSH number will not change very much in a 24-hour period. If you go beyond that, you ran out of your medication, you skipped it for a few days, it would take 2 to 3 days for that TSH to start rising.
At least, closer to like a week to 2 weeks to see that the TSH change. So it's really hard to base someone's dose on a TSH alone.
I had a patient probably about a month and a half, almost probably 2 months ago now. She got a few different prescriptions and she made a mistake and thought that her one medication was her thyroid medication, and her TSH went from we had it perfect. I mean, it was pretty much perfect. Her TSH went up to 50-59.
Because she wasn't taking
Taking anything. Oh. She goes, oh, I've been feeling really tired and, I just been kind of dragging. And I'm like, your TSH is 59. What's going on? I'm thinking, we got to change pharmacies. Something's going on. What's the batch number? You know, all this crazy stuff. And then as we are talking, she realized in the middle of our conversation, she goes, oh, darn, I was taking the wrong medication the whole time. Now, some pharmacies, this is pretty clever, they will color coat the capsules. So they can change the color of the capsules. So progesterone might be this and thyroid will be that and LDN will be that. That was her case. She's taking a few different ones and she got them mixed up and she thought she was taking her thyroid and she was taking no thyroid for over a month. It might've been just about a month. Her TSH went from a great range, like right around one. I don't remember where it started out. It might even been below one, like point, like you said, 0.6, 0.7, which is a great spot to be. And when we redid blood work, it was 59. Now we got it back down after she's been back on the same dose. Now it's down, recent labs was down to 4.5. We still got a little bit more work to go, but I don't want to, once we realize the situation, now we don't have to overreact a little bit, just go back on the medication, see where you end up. And now we just made a slight adjustment based on that. But once she was obviously back on the medication, she felt fine. So there's no sense to overreact. But now that's another thing. Now, granted, we're getting way down the rabbit's hole on this one. Not to say that compounded thyroid is complicated, but you have to know about some of these pitfalls because I think a lot of the problems that people have that are prescribed compounded thyroid is because they're just never dosed enough. Now, another issue that we have both seen specifically with the thyroidectomy patients is for whatever reason, they're on a pretty good dose of both the T4 and the T3 and they're skyrocket. They're taking it every single day and they're skyrocket, or their TSH skyrockets. Have you seen that? I know you've seen that before. We both have seen that many times. Why do you think that happens? And there's not really a good, it's got something to do with the sustained release nature, the methylcellulose they put in there, but I don't know exactly why.
You know, everybody's different. Some people, honestly, I think it might be a little bit digestive. So sometimes I'll have people take their thyroid with a digestive enzyme. And then also sometimes just because they don't have a thyroid that I'll have them take the thyroid. I'll split the dose up into two. They take it in the morning on an empty stomach and then take it before bed as long as they haven't eaten in about two to four hours.
There's some big difference that instant release medications lower TSH very easily. Very easily. Like you don't need a lot of a dose to make your TSH drop. But for some reason in those, specifically those thyroidectomy patients, their TSH can be in the first, let's say 6 to 15 months, the first year and a half, they've been switched over. Their body does not respond the same and their free T3 might be okay. They might feel okay, but their TSH stays elevated for quite a while.
I don't find that. Usually if somebody's TSH is pretty high, I'm trying to work pretty hard to get that down well before a year and a half.
Yeah. No, it'll just for some random reason, it just sort of spikes a little bit. I've seen it a few times.
I've seen that too. Like I said, I think it's digestive wise. And to be honest, and I mean myself too, I've done this before. If you don't have a thyroid, take your thyroid every day. Like that is number one thing that you do. I've had a few people where they kind of forget it or they run out and it takes 2 weeks to get to them or they ran out. Or I've talked to patients like, yeah, I've been taking my thyroid for, you know, a couple of months. And we have to, you know, go over how important that is.
Well, you don't have a thyroid gland, you can't do that.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Like I said, I have a thyroid. I take thyroid. I might forget it. Like the other day, I was like, did I take it? Because usually I take the thyroid and then I turn the bottle upside down. I know a lot of people also do like little pill cases. I have those all over. But I'll take the thyroid and then I'll turn it upside down so that I know that I took it. I do that with the progesterone at night too. I take it and then I turn it upside down. But the other day I didn't do that. I wasn't sure if I took it or not, so I just skipped it. But I've done that before. A lot of people do that before. But I'd say if you don't have a thyroid gland, you want to be extra careful that you take it every day.
And I know you and I have seen the issue with no thyroid gland with a rising TSH. I'm just saying it takes a while for that TSH to drop into a normal range.
Yeah. So if somebody doesn't have a thyroid and we're switching over to a compounded sustained release T4, T3, then I will check it, you know, soon. You know, take this, check it. Their TSH went up to 7.5. We got to raise up the dose.
Or even higher, because that's the big transition, right? That's why we're telling them, when we switch from this to this, just don't freak out when your TSH rises. Well, that's what I'm talking about.
I have a couple of theories for that, but that's why, like you said, I don't like the word aggressive, but I am very, I don't know what the word would be, but I do kind of push the envelope a little bit with those doses when I switch them over.
Very much you do.
Because I don't want to see a TSH in the 20s.
Of course.
I don't want to see it in the teens.
But my point is it's taken a long time to be able to figure that out. That if you use those conversion charts and you can switch someone from a conventional T4 to a compounded, their TSH is going to go up.
Well,
it will in some cases, especially a thyroidectomy patient, it will skyrocket.
What I've always thought, and I mean, maybe I need to do some research into this, is when you take the instant release and it goes right into your system so fast, your body is pretty smart. Your brain, that pituitary, says, wow, that thyroid level went up.
Right.
Because if that's why everybody that's on a levothyroxine or a T4 instant release monotherapy, their doctors always say, don't take your thyroid the morning of your blood draw. Because if they did, they would see that T4 really high. Because that's why they tell them not to. I'm on a different, you know, I have people on a different type of thyroid. I will tell them, do take your thyroid with it. But if somebody with a T4 levothyroxine took their thyroid, went into a blood draw, they would see that T4 is pretty high. And when you have, this is just what I think, this is my opinion, when that T4 jumps way up in your bloodstream when you first take it in the morning, it immediately causes that brain to see it. And that's why the TSH is always right. low. Yeah. Where when you do a sustained release and it doesn't have that quick impulse, that huge pulsating rise of the T4 or even the T3 is it's more gentle. It comes up and stays up, that it doesn't have that effect that you actually, I think in some respects, you get a real, real reading of what your true TSH is when you do it that way.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. That's why we tell everyone to do it that way. But there's just a lot of information on the internet that sort of contradicts that. Like I said, with compounded thyroid, your TSH in a 24-hour period does not change very much. But that's my point. So when you a TSH hormone released from the pituitary, it is responding to the T4 in the blood. So what you just said is exactly right. You raise that T4 in the blood, your TSH is going to plummet, right? But that is just all you're doing is focusing on one hormone that has no effect on how you feel. The TSH means, I mean, it means a lot just in general as a screening number, but especially for a thyroidectomy patient, you don't really even have to pay attention to the TSH. The TSH means nothing because they don't have a gland anymore. So they are people like Tracy. That's why this one is so interesting, because the thyroidectomy patients, now granted, that's not that many people necessarily compared to the hypothyroid people. But they're in a completely different category where the TSH is almost, innocuous. Like it really doesn't mean anything. You should not base a thyroidectomy. That's my take home message is that you should not be basing a thyroidectomy patient's dose on their TSH.
And I put it out there that you should not base anybody's thyroid dose, regardless of if they have a thyroid or not, based on just a simple TSH.
Yeah, no, it's a bad test. It's a good screening test, which is what it's designed for, to catch people that are hypothyroid, but it's a terrible management number when you're trying to optimize how they feel.
That's a good way of putting it, management. The TSH, you do not want to manage someone's thyroid based on a simple TSH. No, I like the free T4 and the free T3. And like you said, if they're on a T4 monotherapy, do the reverse T3.
Yeah, yeah. If you're on 100 micrograms or more of T4 monotherapy, then do a reverse T3, because the higher that T4 dose goes only, if you're on T4 only, the higher that dose goes, it probably won't happen too much on the 75, anything below 100 micrograms, but anything over 100 micrograms, depending on the size of the person, your reverse T3 is going to be either high normal or in fact elevated. That's exactly what you're trying to counteract by adding in the T3, which is why we like the sustained release compounded thyroid so much. So I think we beat this. I think we beat this one to death. I think this one is officially dead. Right. I think we slice and dice this one just about every way that we can. Hopefully that was not, it was kind of fun to talk about. I mean, it was
all in all, to summarize, yeah. Based on Tracy's question, if you are going into perimenopause and menopause, have your thyroid checked, because it could drop the perimenopause and menopause could drop those levels for optimization.
Yeah.
Sum it up.
We could keep, right now we're at about, we've been doing this for just under an hour. Oh. We could probably keep going. Honestly, we could just keep, there's so many more rabbit holes we could go down, but we'll end everybody's suffering, as we're droning on and on about, T4 and T3 TSH, and TSH. This and that. And, anyways, this one was really fun. Yeah. Do you have any closing comments for, compounded thyroid?
No, thank you, Tracy, for your two questions.
Yeah, it was great. Until next time, I'm Dr. Mackey.
And I'm Dr. Davidson.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Progress Your Health podcast. If you like what you've heard on this podcast, please give us a positive review on iTunes. This allows us to spread our message, grow our audience, and help more people around the world. For more information, visit our website at progressyourhealth.com.